In India, the pain of COVID keeps rising every day. In New Delhi, people have become so desperate, they're trying to find oxygen and medical supplies on social media.
It's like a war. This is like a third world war. We don't know what to do. We really don't know what to do.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, when tourists visit Mexico, a lot of them don't bother to put on a face mask. Now some locals are getting annoyed.
We've been saving ourselves in our homes, and then we go out and this happens.
And a cartographer set out to map global land holdings of the Catholic Church, then came to a stark conclusion.
If religious institutions don't figure out how to manage their land, climate change will not be solved.
And we'll hear why human rights advocates don't want the favorite in the Kentucky Derby to race this weekend. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's good to have you with us today. We've been watching in agony as India, on the other side of the globe, struggles with the pandemic. Each day, the infections climb higher. India's healthcare system can't keep pace, nor, sadly, the crematoriums. Just listen to this description from the BBC's Yogita Lamai, reporting from a crematorium in India's capital, New Delhi.
Everywhere I look, there are funeral pyres burning. The air is full of smoke. My eyes are watering.
Crematoriums out of space are resigned to building pyres in the parking lots. In New Delhi, the most in-demand medical supplies have been exhausted. Hospital beds are scarce. One woman, Nishi Sharma, told the BBC that she couldn't find a bed for her mother-in-law, who was struggling to breathe. Sharma went from hospital to hospital, found a doctor, and begged for help.
I literally started crying in front of him that, please, I just need one bed for her. You told me that, you know, that there is a bed. That's why I came here.
In desperation, Indians have been turning to social media in a search for medicine and oxygen tanks to keep their loved ones alive. Manish Pandey is seeing this firsthand. He's one of hundreds of volunteers at the COVIDResources.in collective in New Delhi. They connect people who need these things with suppliers who have them. I asked him to explain how crowdsourcing these critical materials actually works.
Well, it started very basic. It started from just replying to tweets because they were looking for help. And then we decided to put a website and some these tech guys. I don't understand much of a tech. I'm not a techie. However, these tech guys have done some magic and they are able to match stuff. If you go to COVIDResources.in right now, you can just put a city and you can put what you need and then you get some, you know, recommendations. It's a completely crowdsourced thing. When people do get help, they upvote it. And they don't get help, they downvote it. So the leads with a lot of downvotes, we just scrape them out later. And we do it every 3 to 4 hours. So wow. We're trying to put our head around and try and be innovative and how we can help bridge gap between demand and supply. Of course, the demand is so high and the supply is so less. I think even the government and the authority, they're trying their best. They're doing in their capacity. However, things are so out of control that nobody knows what to do.
So I know oxygen is one crucial commodity right now. What kind of requests are you seeing online? What do people need the most?
If you do a small Twitter search right now, Delhi COVID, let's say two keywords, you will see that the requests are dropping in for things like remdesivir. It's an injection, I guess, which is helping. Then there is an injection called Tosi. I mean, I'm not a medical guy as well, so I got to hear these words for the first time in my life. People are asking for ICU beds, for hospital beds. Everything. I mean, it's very bad. You know, these are genuine people who are suffering. They're reaching out. They don't know what to do. And that's why they're turning to social media.
So, Manish, you're helping out with COVID swirling all around you. How has COVID affected your own family?
Luckily, my family, nobody got affected. However, I lost my friends. My school juniors, they were doctors themselves in a small place somewhere in India. Mm. And 4 of them, they passed away just day before yesterday. Because they did not get proper medication. One of my friend died because he did not get an ICU bed. And it's really heartbreaking. And I'm keeping all of this aside right now. I know that I have to be emotionally very intelligent, mentally very tough. Because we're suppressing our emotions and we're trying to do all we can by being the tougher one, by being that, you know, by taking... It's like a war. Marco, it is seriously like a war. This is like a third world war. We don't know what to do. We really don't know what to do.
I'm so sorry to hear about your friends, and it is a terrible situation when you have to just compartmentalize and put those thoughts out of your mind.
People are dying all around, Marcos. People are dying all around, you know. A couple of days ago, there was wait list to even cremate the bodies. Can you imagine how grave is that?
So it looks like a lot of volunteers have been helping out with COVIDresources.in. It seems to be growing by the day. Do you think your volunteer work is making a difference?
It is. It is. The kind of messages we receive every day is very overwhelming. End of the day, when we receive a message like, oh, thank you so much, we got an ICU bed, or maybe you got one cylinder of oxygen, it really helps. At the same time, it really breaks our heart. I have experienced it myself. I think 3 days ago, I did arrange an oxygen cylinder for an ailing patient. The oxygen cylinder reached the doorstep and the patient did not make it. He passed away and we couldn't help. And it is really heartbreaking, you know, just because a couple of hours of delay and we lost somebody. And there are thousands and thousands of cases like that.
Yeah, you said it was like a war. I mean, there are no guarantees here. Why did you feel you had to get personally involved at this level, Manish?
I don't know. You know, I'm out there on Twitter and I felt it is a sense of responsibility, not because I'm an Indian, not because it's affecting me, because it's about humanity, right? It's about helping one human to another. I don't care who I'm helping right now. I just want to help. And there are hundreds like me who are trying to help, not just in COVIDresources.in. Many, many teams are doing such kind of work. And I think 1,000 more teams should come and do this work, because the more people we have, the better help we can get.
Manish Pandey volunteers at the COVIDresources.in collective in New Delhi, speaking with us about how local community initiatives are helping get people COVID supplies across the country. Manish, thank you for your time and thank you for the work you're doing.
Yes, Marcos, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Today is President Biden's 100th day in the White House, and last night he addressed Congress. He laid out an ambitious domestic agenda. When it comes to the rest of the globe, Biden struck a collaborative tone on foreign policy.
No one nation can deal with all the crises of our time, from terrorism to nuclear proliferation, mass migration, cybersecurity, climate change, as well as experiencing what we're experiencing now, pandemics.
The president also spoke about two other things that we took special notice of: overhauling the immigration system and laying out goals to combat climate change. For that, we turn to our environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, and our immigration editor, Monica Campbell. Let me start with you, Carolyn. What stood out for you?
Marco, in a speech that was pretty focused on jobs and the economy, he actually talked about climate change a lot. By my count, he mentioned the word climate 7 times, which is more than any State of the Union or joint address to Congress in the last 30 years. And it wasn't one standalone issue. It was woven into the larger themes of his speech. He first talked about working against climate change as a job creator.
For too long, we've failed to use the most important word when it comes to meeting the climate crisis: jobs.
But he also talked about climate change as a foreign policy issue that requires multilateral cooperation and as an engine to drive U.S. competitiveness.
And that differs from past years, right?
Climate change in State of the Unions has been referred to more as, you know, an energy environment issue, more as a domestic issue. And here it was a foreign policy issue. It was an across-the-board issue, which I think reflects the Biden administration's approach, which is that they want to tackle climate change with a, quote, all-of-government approach.
Biden also mentioned how the U.S. compares to other countries in terms of emissions.
The United States accounts, as all of you know, less than 15% of carbon emissions. The rest of the world accounts for 85%. That's why I kept my commitment to rejoin the Paris Accord, because if we do everything perfectly, it's not going to only matter.
What did you make of that, Carolyn?
His point here is that climate change is an issue that requires international cooperation. The U.S. can't go it alone. That last line is a little puzzling. It kind of sounds like he's saying that even if the U.S. does everything perfectly, it's not going to matter or only going to matter so much. That line was not in his prepared remarks. What the U.S. does clearly does matter. It's the second biggest emitter after China. But I think there's some really important historical context that's missing from that 15% number that's also important to talk about.
The 15% of global greenhouse gas emissions that the U.S. emits.
Yeah, it's true. It also doesn't address the historical issue here, which is that the U.S. is the largest historical emitter. We are the most responsible for the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that are currently in the atmosphere, which is what matters when we're talking about the climate crisis. The U.S. also only makes up 4% of the global population and still emits 15% of greenhouse gas emissions. So our historical and proportional responsibility here is maybe larger than that 15% number would convey.
All right, Carolyn, stay right there. Let me turn to our own Monica Campbell. Monica, as you listened to Biden's remarks on immigration last night, what did you hear?
Soon after taking office, he proposed bold immigration reform. That reform would bring a pathway to citizenship to the nearly 11 million undocumented immigrants in the United States. It would expand legal immigration opportunities and fund border security technology. And Biden emphasized the need to do this.
Immigrants have done so much for America during this pandemic and throughout our history. The country supports immigration reform. We should act. Let's argue over it. Let's debate it. But let's act.
Biden is aware that there is public support to address immigration. He also knows that voters from immigrant communities, particularly Latinos, were critical for his election.
Biden says we should act on immigration reform. We also know that that is a big challenge. Decades have gone by without passage of major immigration reform, even when there was bipartisan support on Capitol Hill. What chances, Monica, does Biden have at getting something major done?
It's going to be very tough. It's been tough for decades, as he mentioned, and particularly as we see more migrants and asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border. Trump gained a lot from doubling down on this issue. Republicans won't let that go so easily. So Biden, in some ways, you know, he's a realist. So while once he spoke about wanting big, bold immigration change, he also pivoted right there and offered a compromise out of the gate.
Let's at least pass what we all agree on. Congress needs to pass legislation this year to finally secure protection for dreamers.
Yeah, lots of applause there. Monica, what if there is not big immigration reform, but rather smaller piecemeal legislation?
Right. So if there's large immigration reform, we'll see obviously many more of the 11 million people offered some sort of legal status or path to citizenship. Smaller scope bills that are in the works may have a better chance of getting through, and that's what Biden was signaling to. That would include, as you mentioned, people who are often called dreamers or people who arrived to the United States as children. We would also see people who work in the agricultural sector, farmers, offered some sort of legal status. But the pressure will be on from advocacy groups to do much more than that. It's still even unclear whether those smaller scope bills will even have a chance of getting through this Congress.
What struck you about what Biden did not say last night?
There was no mention of what is happening at the U.S.-Mexico border, that there is indeed a steep rise in migrants and asylum seekers there, that currently within the United States, we have more than 20,000 kids and teenagers in federal government custody. It's a precarious situation for a lot of these kids.
So, Monica and Carolyn, let me bring you back into the conversation. Climate and immigration, two areas that involve other countries. So what's the bottom line on international agreements and expectations on both climate and immigration? Carolyn, you first on climate.
Well, President Biden was positioning the U.S. as a global leader on climate change in this speech, but really how much the U.S. can lead internationally depends on how much it can get done domestically. Biden insists that he can meet his ambitious new goal to cut carbon emissions 50% by 2030 without the help of Congress. There's a lot of skepticism that that's true, but we'll know more in the next couple of months regarding what happens with the $2 trillion jobs and infrastructure plan. So, you know, he's saying we're going to lead internationally, but it kind of depends on what happens here on domestic soil.
You know, in contrast, there was an expectation that Biden would perhaps reannounce America's leading role in accepting refugees around the world. Trump essentially froze the U.S. refugee program, and there is a expectation that Biden will restore the program. He hasn't yet, and last night was seen as perhaps an opportunity to announce that. It's we're still waiting for that.
The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, and our environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, diving into President Biden's remarks last night. Thank you both very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Marco.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The annual Kentucky Derby is on Saturday. The horse favored to win this year is named Essential Quality. The horse's owner is Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum. He's the vice president and prime minister of the United Arab Emirates and ruler of the Emirate of Dubai. Some human rights lawyers don't want his horse to compete, and they've made themselves known to the Kentucky Horse Racing Commission. Sam Markison is one of the authors of the complaint. He teaches law at the University of Louisville's Brandeis School of Law. Professor Markison, why should the Sheikh and his horse be banned from the Derby?
Sheikh Mohammed is a clear violator of human rights. He has been found by a British court to have abducted and be holding his 35-year-old daughter, Princess Latifah, since 2018 against her will after she tried to escape and ultimately seek asylum in the United States. He violated international law by seizing a U.S.-flagged vessel in international waters using commandos hired by him for that purpose. He violates human rights. And under our law here in Kentucky, that empowers the Horse Racing Commission here to bar him as someone who brings disrepute upon the horse racing industry.
What is the update on his daughter, Princess Latifah? When was the last time anyone heard from her?
She has managed to smuggle out some videos. She has described her conditions, her fear for her life, that she is being held against her will. But other than those videos, no one has seen her from outside of Dubai other than Mary Robinson, who attested to her belief that Latifah was well, but later acknowledged that she had been manipulated and regretted very much that she had made those statements and calling for Latifah's release.
You filed the same complaint to the Kentucky Horse Racing Commission in 2019. It was not acted upon then. What's changed since then? Anything to suggest the outcome will be different this time?
Well, we don't know if the outcome will be different, but the Horse Racing Commission told us in 2019 that they were not going to act based on what they called mere press reports of what had happened to Latifah and that Sheikh Mohammed was involved. Now, 2 years later, we do have the British court decision that found these allegations to be true, that found the witnesses who attested to what happened when she was abducted to be credible. And with those findings of a court of law, we think that makes for a very different situation and puts the onus on the Kentucky Horse Racing Commission. What they were implicitly saying was if there was a basis that they found credible, they would act. And now's their opportunity to actually do so, and we think they need to.
Sheikh Mohammed has run 10 horses in the Derby since 1999. How well known is the Sheikh in Kentucky? Like, if you mention the Sheikh, does everyone know whom you're talking about?
Oh, there is no doubt that he is one of the most important people in the Kentucky horse racing industry. His Godolphin stables own two breeding farms, and they employ hundreds of people. They would absolutely know. If anyone has any involvement whatsoever in horse racing or any familiarity with horse racing, he would be as prominent and as well known as anyone this side of Bob Baffert, the trainer of six Kentucky Derby winners.
Is the Sheikh expected to be at the Derby on Saturday?
He is not. We have been informed that he is not planning to attend, and obviously his connections, the trainer and others with the stable, will be there. You know, we hope that people aren't sort of blaming the messenger, that, you know, they feel like we're somehow diminishing or taking something away from the Derby. But instead, look at Sheikh Mohammed as the reason why this is happening and hopefully join the call that will hopefully at some point result in Latifah being released.
Sam Markison teaches law at the University of Louisville's Brandeis School of Law. He's one of the authors of the complaint filed yesterday to try to bar Dubai's Sheikh Mohammed and his horse Essential Quality from running in Saturday's Kentucky Derby. Sam, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
6 years ago this spring, Pope Francis released a landmark encyclical on the environment. The teaching document framed taking care of the earth as a moral and ethical issue. It called on Catholics around the world to join the fight against climate change. Our next guest is challenging the church itself to use its vast holdings of land as part of the solution. That's today on The Big Fix.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Molly Berhans is a cartographer and environmentalist from Connecticut. She's also Catholic, and for the last 5 years, she's been on a quest to map the church's land, a huge undertaking.
The Catholic Church, it has its own set of jurisdictions that contiguously cover the face of the earth, almost like, you know, nation states.
The church is also the largest non-state landowner in the world. Since 2016, Berhens has been working with Vatican Records to map that land with the nonprofit she founded called Goodlands. In some countries, her maps provide a detailed picture of every property the Catholic Church owns, from church grounds to schools to hospitals.
It was just completely surprising, actually, to learn that this hadn't been mapped yet. The history of cartography in the Vatican is rich.
But Berhens says those maps are really out of date.
There is kind of a cutoff of map making globally for the Catholic Church, and it seems to be around the 1850s.
Berhens says she was inspired by time she spent with nuns when she was in her early 20s. She was struck by their humility and commitment to justice. To her, there's a direct line between those values and how land is used and managed.
Our land is where we get resources to make the clothes, to clothe the naked, to quote scripture. It's where we build the shelter to house the homeless. And it is where we grow the food to feed the hungry.
Berhens says being able to see the church and its people on a map can help leaders plan for climate change.
Making decisions about land really requires, I would say, maps to do it with any sort of environmental integrity.
Berhens is currently getting more requests to do environmental assessments on religious properties. Those could, for example, help leaders understand how to better protect habitat for threatened plants and animals on church-owned land, or see the vulnerability of community members to climate-fueled natural disasters. Berhens told me when we spoke that she and her group have already made a map visualizing rising sea levels on church properties here in Boston.
We flooded all the Catholic properties within the Boston Archdiocese, so that helps them see, you know, where stormwater management is potentially going to be an issue based on climate models.
So, Molly, this is kind of your brainchild. How deeply is the Vatican interested in working with you on this? And what is your ideal for how far they should take this stewardship of their land?
Well, I think that Catholic conservation should be the next Catholic healthcare. I think it should be the largest global network of its kind within a century. That would be very nice, right?
That's ambitious.
I know. I'm not planning on doing it all myself. Don't worry. Faith-based organizations own, the UN estimates, 8% of the habitable land on Earth. It's about the same size as India and Sudan combined. If religious institutions don't figure out how to manage their land, climate change will not be solved. They're absolutely key. In 2018, Pope Francis did approve that I establish an institution in the Vatican. So I kind of made a very comprehensive proposal, which I was supposed to be renegotiating last year when the pandemic hit. So, you know, we'll see where it goes.
Where does it go next? What's next for your project?
We're going to continue working with not just the Catholic Church, but other kind of communities who can benefit from the approach that we use with this optimization of their property portfolios based on science and values. We're getting requests from a diversity of institutions.
Molly Berhens is a founder of Goodlands. Her organization makes maps to help institutions make better environmental decisions about their land, starting with the Catholic Church. Molly, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks very much, Marco.
You're with the world. In China, the COVID vaccine campaign is tricky. A writer in Shanghai says some of her relatives are not just vaccine hesitant, they don't trust the vaccine.
Because there are no cases in the province where they live, they see the vaccination more as fulfilling a requirement from the government than doing something that protects themselves.
Vaccine mistrust still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Here in the U.S., we can breathe freely again in certain outdoor situations. That's after the CDC loosened its recommendations for face masks outside. In Mexico, the government suggests that people keep them on. Despite that, many travelers from the U.S. and elsewhere are visiting Mexico and ditching the masks. The World's Mexico City correspondent Jorge Valencia reports.
A lot of people are noticing more and more visitors without masks. Take digital content producer Cheryl Santos.
2 weekends ago, I was with a friend waiting for our order of tacos in the streets in one of the main streets, so crowded right now.
When she made eye contact with a man who was walking by, she says he was tall, bald, and speaking to someone in what sounded like American English.
And he was not wearing a mask, and I guess he felt a little bit judged, I don't know. And he starts screaming at me, like, what? What do you want? What are you looking at?
Santos says she felt intimidated. The guy was like twice her size. She's about 5'1". But she was mad and she didn't back down.
I'm sorry I wasn't a better person, but I was just start yelling back, saying, like, wear a mask.
Santos posted about her experience on Instagram, and she says she got response after response from other friends in Mexico who were also annoyed about this.
The thing is, I'm a cautious person. I'm not policing anyone. I don't care whatever it is that you do. But we've been saving ourselves in our homes, and then we go out, and this happens.
Travelers from the U.S. and other corners of the world have been visiting Mexico for months, enjoying their visit with few pandemic restrictions. Officials only loosely enforce measures to prevent the spread of the coronavirus, and many tourists don't even bother to wear a face mask outdoors. Dr. Gustavo Olaiz is a former epidemiologist with the Pan American Health Organization. He says public health officials here are doing their best to prevent a third, fourth, or fifth wave, but that politicians are ignoring them. For example, President Andrés Manuel López Obrador has almost never been seen wearing a face mask in public.
We are really bad. Compare, for example, with China, Japan, and some other areas that were affected heavily by the first SARS epidemic.
And where leaders and the general public don't scoff at face coverings or physical distancing measures. Olaiz says the Mexican government could help prevent the spread of the five known strains in the world if it required a negative test for entry. He says he also wishes visitors knew Mexico has one of the highest death rates in the world.
If you have the discipline in your country to wear masks, social distancing, and other public health measures, continue to use those. I mean, the virus is here and the virus is there. You don't have a break by coming into Mexico.
Can I just ask you a couple of questions?
Yeah, of course.
So I double masked and I went to meet some tourists near downtown Mexico City. I spoke with visitors from Canada, Czech Republic, and these two guys from Switzerland, Simon Camilo and Andre Anderson.
What was the purpose of your visit?
Culture, beach, food, girls.
So I was were you guys concerned at all about the pandemic and about the coronavirus when you decided to travel?
We met so many people from around the world because I think right here in Mexico, it's the only place you can go where, like, still people are, like, living the normal way of life, kind of.
Because I guess that's what I was wondering, if you were concerned that you might get sick.
No, I don't think about getting sick.
Same, actually. I had already coronavirus like 5 months ago.
What about the face masks? I was wondering, why did you decide to not wear a face mask today?
Actually, we got the mask with us, but it just too hot. So now I just need to breathe normally.
Yeah, because I asked the reception, is it forbidden to go out on the street? And I said, no, only when you go inside. And yeah, can I ask you a question? I mean,
yeah, please.
Do you think we should wear a mask on the street for protect the people around us?
Yeah, I think so, yes.
All right, okay, then I'm going to wear a mask now.
Thank you so much.
Gracias.
Thank you.
Ciao.
Visitors like Simon Camilo and Andre Anderson are welcome in Mexico, says digital content producer Cheryl Santos. Many business owners depend on them, including Herb. She runs a t-shirt company called Sauna that sells a lot to tourists.
In general, we like foreigners. We like to show them what's Mexico City, or like Mexico in general, is about. It's just the ones that they really, really don't care about anything here. Those are the ones that we would like to be more considerate.
By doing something as simple, Santos says, as protecting themselves and protecting the people they're visiting. For the World, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
In factories around the globe, millions of people are forced to do work against their will. Many governments, including the U.S., are stepping up efforts to do something about that by imposing sanctions or monitoring a company's supply chain. Advocates say U.S. Customs and Border Patrol could play a crucial role in the effort by seizing imported goods made with forced labor. But as the world's Rupa Shenoy reports, that comes with some challenges.
Gloves can keep us out of harm's way, wherever we may be and whatever we may be doing.
This is a promotional video from the world's largest manufacturer of plastic disposable gloves. It commands a fourth of the global market. Last year, with the pandemic, demand soared.
Top Glove. We have been saving and protecting lives all over the globe.
But in order to do so, Top Glove used forced labor in Malaysia. That's according to evidence gathered by U.S. Customs and Border Protection, or CBP. As a result, last month, CBP banned Top Glove products and began seizing its shipments coming into the U.S.
supervisor position deko banma arule complain gare eta uti kaam ko bare
an interpreter helped me talk to a man who has worked in a Top Glove factory in Malaysia for 7 years. He didn't want to give his name for fear of losing his job. He supports his parents, wife, son and daughter. They're from Nepal. For years, he says, supervisors forced employees to work 12 to 15 hour shifts. Workers were packed tightly into each factory room. Last year, that resulted in a massive COVID outbreak. I asked him if things had changed since the U.S. banned Top Glove. Things have gotten better, he says. Now they're allowed to work just 8-hour shifts, and fewer workers are stationed in each room. John Leonard says that's what's supposed to happen. He's CPB's top trade enforcement official and oversees its efforts to combat forced labor.
Frankly, it all comes down to economics. They want to stay in business if a lot of their market is in the U.S. They'll take those steps, and that's what you want to happen, because hopefully the lives of the workers will be better.
U.S. law prohibits imports made with forced labor, but until 2016, there was a loophole that allowed goods in if there was consumer demand. Congress closed that loophole, and Leonard says ever since, CBP, the largest federal law enforcement agency, has been ramping up.
It's an evolution. CBP is getting better at it, literally week by week, month by month.
Currently, it has 48 active bans in place. That includes one on cotton and tomato products from the Xinjiang province of China, where independent groups have found Uyghurs are being forced to work in factories. Leonard says since October, CBP has stopped about 350 shipments worth $50 million.
And this mission set is very emotional for us. And it is something that the folks that work in that area take a lot of pride in. And I think it really motivates them.
Despite that pride, some say there are things CBP needs to do better in order to address the immense problem of forced labor. A Government Accountability Office report found CBP doesn't have the right staffing in place to really scale up. Some investigations stalled because there was no one to do them. The GAO also found CBP hasn't been transparent about the process companies have to go through to get sanctions lifted. Luciano Rocco is with the firm Foley Hoag, which advises companies on international compliance.
CBP is acting as the investigator, judge, and jury in these matters, and there's typically no public explanation of what specific evidence CBP relied on in determining that there was reasonable or conclusive evidence of the use of forced labor or child labor.
That complaint is echoed by Esmeralda Lopez, legal and policy director of the Global Justice International Labor Rights Forum.
Currently, when a petitioner files an allegation with CBP, like my organization, there is no clear standard by which we know that CBP is making its decision.
Lopez says her group has provided evidence about companies that it was sure would result in a ban, or in CPB jargon, a withhold release order.
We have submitted petitions for which the withhold release orders have not been issued, and we believe that they should have been.
Leonard at CBP says his agency tries to be as transparent as possible. He says an interdisciplinary group inside CBP gathers evidence to determine a finding of forced labor as defined by the International Labor Organization. They look at media reports or reports by other government agencies and consider information from non-governmental organizations and civil society groups. CBP personnel overseas also evaluate working conditions.
You know, ultimately, like a lot of federal agencies, the final decisions are made up here in headquarters in Washington, D.C., but we get a lot of input from our folks all around the country and folks that work in our ports of entry.
The Top Glove worker in Malaysia I talked to hopes the U.S. finds a way to do more, because he says worker abuse is rampant. If the U.S. refuses to buy the goods they make, he says it could change a lot of lives. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
In Pakistan, after weeks of violent protests, the government has caved to a hardline Islamist group, the TLP. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has more now on what the TLP is.
This month in Pakistan, hundreds of thousands of people went into the streets to protest. They brought the country to a standstill. The protests soon turned violent. At least four policemen and an unknown number of protesters were killed. Hundreds more were wounded, and in Lahore, protesters took 11 policemen hostage. The protests were organized by a group called Tehreek-e-Labbaik, or TLP. It's a hardline Islamist group. It wants Islamabad to expel the French ambassador to Pakistan and ban French goods because of something that happened in France last year. The newspaper Charlie Hebdo decided to reprint caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad. On the streets of Lahore, one protester, a man named Ahmed Qadri, spoke to local television stations. He says, "We want the police either to shoot us or expel the French ambassador because there is nothing more important to us than the honor of the Prophet." Islamist groups are nothing new in Pakistan, but what is new is that in just a few years, the TLP has become one of Pakistan's most powerful lobbies, paralyzing the country with violent protests and dictating terms to the government. So, what happened? The TLP began as a faction in 2015. A Christian Pakistani woman, Azia Bibi, was put on death row for insulting the Quran. The then governor of Punjab said she should be pardoned. For that, he was assassinated, shot 27 times by his bodyguard.
Late Punjab Governor Salman Taseer was passing through Kosar Market in Islamabad when one of his security guards shot him dead.
The bodyguard, Mumtaz Qadri, was arrested and sentenced to death under the law of the land. And the TLP, it came together as a group calling for Qadri's release. He was hanged in 2016, but the TLP kept looking for blasphemers. The French are only the latest. The TLP can mobilize huge crowds by playing on religious sentiment, says Hassan Abbas. Abbas is an expert on religious extremism at National Defense University in Washington and the author of The Prophet's Heir.
The idea is that this group is the defender of the honor of the Prophet. For ordinary people on the street, without knowing the intricacies or the nuances or the details, they are just made to believe that they, by coming out on the streets, by blocking the road, by pressurizing the government, they are the frontline group in the world today, which is defending the honor of the Prophet.
Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan has struggled with how to contain the TLP. About a week into this month's riots, Khan said he would not be blackmailed by violence, and he banned the TLP under the country's anti-terrorism laws. Extremism scholar Hassan Abbas.
The TLP thugs were seen on the Pakistani television screens across the country, beating up police, kidnapping police officials. Imran Khan took a principled stand that we are declaring this organization to be a terrorist organization.
But then, 2 days later, Khan's government changed its position. Pakistan's Interior Minister, Sheikh Rashid Ahmed, announced the government would negotiate with the TLP and take up a resolution in parliament to expel the French ambassador. Hussein Haqqani was Pakistan's ambassador to the U.S. Now he's with the Hudson Institute, a think tank in Washington. He says Khan is trying to balance international pressure with the risk of alienating Pakistan's conservatives.
These protests came at a time when Pakistan is about to face a hearing from the UN's task force on money laundering and terrorist financing. So Prime Minister Imran Khan is trying to appear tough, that yes, we are acting against any group that engages in violence. So he banned them, to tell the world he was acting against them, and then he started negotiating with them to be able to keep them on his side.
Scholars say there's a pattern here, one that goes way back. Raza Rumi is a political scientist at Ithaca College.
You know, in a way, what Imran Khan is doing is symptomatic of the larger story of Pakistani state, because it has always capitulated to clergy.
Rumi says the religious right has always had an outsized influence on the government.
And the mullahs have always kind of dictated their will whether it comes to constitution making, laws, or other important issues. And the state has always had to surrender because Pakistan identifies itself as an Islamic country.
Last week, Pakistan's National Assembly started debate on the resolution to expel the French ambassador.
Jis par house ke is taraf aadmi baitha ho, us taraf baitha ho, pura Pakistan mutafik hai.
Lawmakers from all major political parties declared their support for the TLP's ideology. The resolution has been tabled for the time being as the country's focus has shifted to COVID. But Ambassador Haqqani says the whole episode has only empowered the fundamentalists.
The secular voices in Pakistan have more or less been shut down. And so basically now everybody is just trying to outdo each other in being an Islamist.
And when that happens, he says, Pakistan becomes more and more isolated on the global stage. For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
In his speech last night, President Biden urged the House to pass the COVID-19 Hate Crimes Act to protect Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. Violence against Asian Americans is the focus of our next online forum with Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. What can policymakers and the public do to combat anti-Asian hate crimes and threats? Email your questions to myworld@theworld.org and stream the conversation live tomorrow at noon Eastern. Details are at theworld.org. The two Chinese coronavirus vaccine manufacturers, Sinovac and Sinopharm, have exported hundreds of millions of doses across the planet. But back home in China, they're battling vaccine skepticism. Most Chinese are not rushing out to get the jab. They're worried about the safety and efficacy of the Chinese vaccines. Shanghai resident and author Yashu Zhang recently got her shot, though, and told us about her experience and the changing levels of trust her fellow Chinese have in authorities and science.
A couple weeks ago, I was searching online to find out when ordinary people in Shanghai could sign up for the vaccine. And last week, I saw this notice in our neighborhood saying that we can now go to the neighborhood office to register. And I was very excited, and I went the next day. Not everybody is so excited about the vaccine. I was just spending some time with my family for the tomb sweeping festival in early April. And people like my cousin have been notified by their neighborhood to go get their first shot. Their attitudes were more like, all right, I'll go at some point, but they didn't feel an urgent need to get it done. And some others, like my uncle, were more concerned about the side effects. He thought those who get it early are like little mice being experimented on. Because there are no cases in the province where they live, they see the vaccination more as fulfilling a requirement from the government than doing something that protects themselves. And in Chinese, we always say 是药三分毒, which means any medicine is 30% poison. So I'm going to get the first shot of the coronavirus vaccine in the afternoon. I didn't think it would be a big deal, but I guess I am a little bit nervous about it because I couldn't fall asleep last night. I arrived at this large center where people in this district go to get vaccinated, and people were queuing up at the entrance. There were lots of loudspeakers. First, there was this one saying, come this way if you're getting your first shot, come that way if it's your second shot. And then there was another saying, people above 60 years old go this way, and below 60 years old go that way. So they tried to keep things in order. When it came to my turn, I first sat down in front of a nurse who asked me to sign a form to make sure I met the requirements for the vaccine. Then I came to another nurse who told me I was getting the vaccine produced by a Beijing company. Then she gave me an injection, which ended before I even felt anything. Then, with more loudspeakers directing the way, I came to this observation area where lots of people were sitting and waiting for their time to leave. The whole process took no more than 45 minutes, and soon I was home again, feeling perfectly fine. And that got me thinking, since early last year, China has been mostly in control of the pandemic, and our life here has been so much less affected by it compared to some other countries. People like to talk about that, so I think how well we've been doing lately definitely helped rebuild people's trust in the government. One good example was in January this year. They found three new local cases in Shanghai, and that was the first time since November that a local case was confirmed. The government quickly tracked down the sources of the outbreak and identified the people they were in touch with. Instead of testing a ton of people and shutting the whole city down, they tried to limit the number of people affected by it and simply locked down a few neighborhoods. I remember reading a feature article about a disease investigator who was involved in this process. He said that tracking down the cases was like trying to trap rats in a porcelain shop. So the goal was not just to find the mice, but also not to break everything. The outbreak was brought under control after about a week, and only 16 cases were confirmed in the end, as far as we know. I think most people in Shanghai were quite proud of how efficiently and effectively the Shanghai government dealt with this. I also have a feeling that in China, science is not completely separate from politics. When we think about science in relation to the coronavirus, we immediately think of the authority figures such as Zhong Nanshan.
Earlier, I talked to Dr. Zhong Nanshan. Professor Zhong is China's...
And Zhang Wenhong.
Dr. Zhang Wenhong is credited with preventing the pandemic from taking hold in Shanghai.
They represent both the experts in controlling the virus and the voice of the government.
Let's find out the answer.
And they've been telling us what to do and what not to do, and people trust them. Most people are happy with how the government has dealt with the pandemic. My mother said proudly that the Shanghai government is one of the most effective in managing crisis. I get the impression that in general, people in China have a high level of trust in authority. They trust that the officially approved vaccine can't be too bad, and they trust that the government is doing the best they can to protect its people. The pandemic has heightened the degree to which we're being watched. We become our health codes, having to show them everywhere we go, and wherever we go, the government knows. But most people think this is done for the common good. We are sacrificing a bit of our individual freedom, but this is how we get things done, and done for the better. As far as the pandemic is concerned, I don't think this is wrong.
That was Shanghai resident Yashu Zhang. Our story was produced by Joyce Hackle and Ian Koss. Finally today, a taste of the future for many of us, but for a bunch of music fans in New Zealand, it's a taste of last Saturday. This is how the network Al Jazeera reported it.
In New Zealand, there is no pandemic, no social distancing or face masks or overwhelmed hospitals. And so it is here that 50,000 fans could cram into a stadium for a concert, a world first since COVID-19 began.
Here was Auckland, New Zealand's biggest stadium, a rock concert, the final stop for the Kiwi band 660. We leave you today with their latest single, All She Wrote. It's already gone. You give and you take, you love and you chase. That's all she wrote. New Zealand's own 660, that's all she wrote. And that's our show today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Be safe, stay strong. Tomorrow's Friday. We'll see you then.